Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to the Children's Justice Project monthly training series. This training is offered to key stakeholders involved in Wyoming's juvenile court system and held every second Tuesday of the month from 12 to 1 p.m. To obtain the materials electronically for today's training, please visit the Children's Justice Project website at www.courts.state.wy.us/initiatives/CJP and then click the training tab in the middle of the screen. If there are any questions, participants are welcome to call in during the last 10 minutes of the training session. The call-in number is area code 917-889-8064. One may also post questions and comments using the online chat session on the Blog Talk Radio website. We hope you'll find today's training informative and would like to thank you for your attendance.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Edie Troutwine, Children's Justice Project Coordinator with the Wyoming Supreme Court. Today is January 14th and want to thank everyone for tuning in to this month's Blog Talk Radio presentation. Today's training topic is reunification as a permanency option. Our presenter today is Lisa Finke. She is an attorney who lives in Gillette, who represents children and families in abuse and neglect cases. Today, Lisa is going to provide us information on reunification as a permanency option in Wyoming child welfare cases. Today you will learn about the benefits and barriers to reunification, as well as methods that can be used to engage families and professionals in reunification. Lisa is going to explain today that removal from the home in these cases is meant to be a temporary solution to safety concerns. Within child welfare cases, the first permanency option should be reunification with the home of origin. The focus of a child welfare case should be reunification unless otherwise ordered by the court, and Lisa will provide information about why professionals should advocate for reunification. The handouts for today's presentation can be downloaded off the CJP website, and I've included that link on the chat line. And with that, I'll turn it over and thank Lisa for presenting on the topic today. Lisa?
Thank you, Edie, and thank you to the Children's Justice Project for allowing me to be here today to get up on my soapbox and talk about something that's been on my mind for quite a while, that of reunification as a permanency option. Now, that phrase, reunification as a permanency option, may sound strange to some people. That's because we as professionals have been somewhat conditioned to think of permanency as something other than returning the child to their parent or home of origin. We attend trainings and seminars, we read articles, and we have discussions about achieving permanency for children. And these items tend to revolve around finding adoptive homes, establishing permanent guardianships, finding other planned permanent living arrangements for older youth aging out of foster care, and how to go about saving children from foster care limbo. We talk about permanency so often in this context that our brains start to associate permanency with termination of parental rights or relinquishment. But in reality, the number one permanency option in every case is and should always be reunification with the parents. I'll begin with a quick overview of my presentation. You should be able to access my PowerPoint presentation from the website. That presentation contains a lot of information, but it won't be necessary to follow along with that presentation while I'm speaking. There's some information in the PowerPoint that I won't touch on today, and there's some things that I'll say today that won't be in the PowerPoint. Please feel free to browse those slides during the presentation. And with that, I'll dive right into reunification as a permanency option. When a child is removed from his or her home of origin, out-of-home placement is intended as a temporary solution until such time as the safety concerns within the home of origin can be addressed. Research shows us that children function better when safety concerns are addressed and the children are returned to their parents. When a child is removed from the home, that's not intended as a tool to place the child in a living situation that we as the professionals deem to be better than the home of origin. By law, child welfare systems are designed to assist in reunification. The reunification process works better when the professionals within the system understand the benefits of and barriers to reunification. Children should be returned to the home as soon as the safety concerns that led to removal have been addressed. This presentation will assist attendees in understanding why reunification should be the first permanency option in every case. Furthermore, it will educate attendees as to the barriers to reunification and the factors that contribute to successful and unsuccessful reunification. At the conclusion of this presentation, attendees should have a clear understanding of the reasons why reunification should be the desired outcome of every case and should have a renewed commitment towards supporting reunifying efforts. So today we're going to talk about reunification as a permanency option. The learning objectives for this program include: 1, the benefits to reunification; 2, the barriers to reunification; 3, the methods to engage families and professionals in reunification; and 4, the reason why professionals should advocate for reunification. In the mental health and substance abuse field, counselors will often talk with their clients about developing coping skills, things that help them get through when they're stressed or overwhelmed. We as professionals develop our own coping skills as well. We have very stressful and emotional jobs, and at the end of the day, sometimes we just need to decompress. I am not afraid to admit that one of my coping skills is binge-watching Netflix, and I'm sure that's a coping skill that many of you share with me as well. In my house right now, we're binge-watching a show called Grey's Anatomy. We start with the first episode, and the goal is to make it all the way through everything that Netflix has. For those of you who aren't familiar with the show Grey's Anatomy, it's a medical drama about doctors, specifically surgeons, and it starts out by following a group of doctors who've just graduated from medical school and are starting their initial hands-on medical training. These doctors start out being supervised by a doctor by the name of Dr. Bailey, who they refer to as the Nazi. Throughout the show, Dr. Bailey is always looking for ways to teach her young interns how to be better doctors, how to be better surgeons. One day, as I was watching one of the earlier episodes of the show, there was a storyline that really struck me and that I personally tied into what I do as a professional in the child welfare field. The storyline focused on an interaction between Dr. Bailey and one of the interns named George. Now, the interns are training to be surgeons. They're young, enthusiastic. They haven't reached the burnout level yet. They're just out of school. They want to get involved in every surgery they can. So when a group of patients comes in, George is the first one out to the ambulance bay, and he makes the mistake of saying in front of Dr. Bailey that he wants in on a really good surgery. Well, Dr. Bailey decides this is the perfect moment to teach George a lesson. The first patient is a middle-aged man who is already dead. The paramedics did CPR in the field for a significant amount of time, and they've had absolutely no response from him. George, of course, pays no attention to this man and wants to wait for the next trauma. Dr. Bailey, of course, assigns George to the case and tells him to do everything he can to save the man. George protests, saying that this man is already dead, and Dr. Bailey's response is that the patient isn't dead until the doctors say he's dead, and George needs to immediately start some sort of life-saving measures. George is incredibly frustrated, but he does what he's told. Throughout this episode, we see George doing one life-saving procedure to another, from CPR to cardiac drugs to cutting the patient's chest open and massaging his heart. Dr. Bailey keeps checking in on him, and every time George says, "This guy is dead, let me move on." And every time Dr. Bailey asks him, "When a patient comes into our hospital, why do we work and work and do everything we can to save him?" George never has the right answer for Dr. Bailey, so she makes him continue to work on the patient. Ultimately, Dr. Bailey allows George to call the patient's time of death and move on. Then, at the conclusion of the episode, a nurse comes and finds George and tells him that the family of the man he was working on is in the lobby. As George is watching the family through the window into the waiting room, he pauses. And out of nowhere, it hits George. When a patient comes into the hospital, why do we work and work and work to save the patient's life? So that we can look the family in the eye at the end of the day and tell them we did everything we could to save their family member. This scene really struck me, and I applied it to myself as a professional. When I'm standing in a permanency hearing as an attorney, and the judge decides that we're headed to termination of parental rights, can I turn to those parents as a GAL, as a parent's attorney, as a child welfare advocate in any role, and say to those parents, I did everything I could to help you put your family back together? Can I look the children in the eye and say, I did everything I could to get you back to your parents? When it comes to reunification, it's easy to sit back and say that it's the parents' responsibility to do what they need to do to get their children back. It's easy to put that burden on the parents. But I believe, and what the law says, and the perspective I will take in this presentation, is that we as professionals have an obligation to make reasonable efforts to reunify the family, and that the burden of reunification is on us just as much as it's on the parents. Now, it's easy working in this field to become jaded and burn out. It's easy to forget that the ultimate goal of the child welfare system is not just to protect the safety and welfare of the children, but to put families back together whenever possible. The best interests of the child come first, but research tells us that the best interest of the child is to be with their family whenever possible. I'm sure many of you have heard comments such as, he has his own room at the foster home. Why should we move him back into a trailer with his parents? Or, if we keep these kids in foster care, they'll get to participate in extracurricular activities. Or, they don't have a couch. We can't send these kids home if they don't have a couch. My favorite one, of course, that I hear in the hallway sometimes is, we need to quit messing around with trying to help these parents. The child needs permanency. We as professionals need to always remember that returning a child to their parents is always the first and best permanency option. So we should probably start by defining permanency. Permanency is having a safe, consistent, nurturing, permanent home in which a child can grow to adulthood. For the majority of children in our country, that's the home of origin. These children are well taken care of and never leave their parents' home until at the age of 18, their parents kick them out because they're sick and tired of dealing with the teenage attitude. But for the children that we work with, something has gone wrong within their home of origin, and the child welfare system has stepped in to address that issue. Now, sometimes children aren't removed from the home when the child welfare system gets involved. For purposes of what we're talking about today, we're talking about the children who are removed from the home. Once the children are removed from the home, the goal is to help them find a permanent home. This can be the home that they were removed from. Reunification is always an option. Now, we all know that there are some extreme cases out there where the children are removed from the home, and we as professionals know that no matter what we do, no matter what the parents do, the children are never going to be able to go back to the home. I'm not advocating that it's in the best interest of every single child to be returned to the home of origin. But for the majority of cases when the child is removed from the home, returning to the home is the best option, and we should actively work towards reunification. So let's take a step back and talk about what reunification is exactly. When a child is removed from the home, they're placed in what is meant to be temporary out-of-home care. Reunification is the process of returning the child from temporary out-of-home care to the family of origin. The goal of the reunification process should be to reunite the children with the families as soon as possible, as soon as any safety issues are addressed. The longer a child remains in out-of-home care, the less likely it becomes that reunification will occur. This is a central concept of reunification, and we should imprint it on our brains. The longer a child is out of the home, the less likely it is to reunify. In any situation where a child can be protected and served at home, reunification should always be the primary goal. The question is always, can this child be safely kept at home with support and community services? So why is reunification the primary goal? Well, first and foremost, because it's the law. Federal law mandates that when a child is in state custody, the state must take steps to reunify the family. That has been codified within our state law. It's a requirement of our state law. In Wyoming, the standard is found in Wyoming Statute 14-3-440A, which requires reasonable efforts to preserve and reunify the family. Specifically, subsection A2 requires reasonable efforts to make it possible for the child to safely return to the child's home. This requirement remains in place until the court modifies the requirement at a permanency hearing. I won't go into reasonable efforts in great deal, but in great detail, but we all know that reasonable efforts are the cornerstone of all child welfare proceedings, and a lack of reasonable efforts can completely ruin a case, both a juvenile case and a termination case. Reasonable efforts are not clearly defined by law, so we're left to interpret what reasonable efforts means on a case-by-case basis. But everything we talk about here today can certainly be a factor in considering whether or not reasonable efforts were made. The second reason why reunification is the primary goal of a child welfare case is that reunification is what is best for the child. The bedrock assumption of child welfare policy is that children are better off if they're raised by their natural parents. While some of this assumption arises out of legal concepts regarding the fundamental rights of parents, it also arises from the idea that it is in the best interest of the children to be with their parents. Well, why is this? Well, for starters, research from the Casey Family Program shows that children who spend an extended time out of the home in foster care experience poorer outcomes than their peers, particularly in the areas of education, employment, and mental health. Research also shows that children can be incredibly traumatized by removal from the home. I was reading a biography the other day of a girl who was removed from the home at the age of 4 and then spent a significant amount of time in foster care before she was eventually adopted. She recounted the day that she was removed from the home and how traumatic it was for her, even at the age of 4. And she remembered this day in great detail. She remembered everything about it, from what she said, what she did, what she heard, what she smelled. But what struck me the most about what she was saying was that as a child, for years, she just wanted to go back to her mother. She just wanted to go back to her home. She just wanted to get back to what she said in her own words, and this is what hit me, she just wanted to get back to normal. Her home was what she was used to. It was what she was comfortable with. She talked about missing her room, her clothes, her toys. And we know, we learned from research, from presentations, from personal experience, that in the majority of cases, no matter how bad the abuse or neglect was in the home, many of these children want to be in the home with their parents, especially younger children. We also know about attachment and how children can be affected when they aren't allowed a natural attachment process with their parents. We know these things. We know that reunification is in the best interest of the children, and yet it can be really hard as a child welfare advocate to advocate for and remain focused on reunification. So why is it so hard in some cases to advocate for reunification? Well, it's because there's a lot of barriers to reunification. First and foremost, it's hard. It's hard to get past that human instinct that this is a child who's been mistreated, and now we're going to send the child back to the person who mistreated them. It's hard to deal with parents who don't live by the same standards that we as professionals live by. And it's hard because, well, some of these parents, they're just not very likable. We all have that one parent that when we see their number on caller ID, we want to crawl under our desk, curl up in the fetal position, plug our ears, and rock back and forth until the phone quits ringing, and then pray that they didn't leave a voicemail. Some of these parents are very difficult to work with, and wrapping your head around reunification can be hard, but it's what we signed up to do when we started working in the child welfare field. So let's talk about some of the other barriers to reunification. Barriers to reunification include workforce staffing and lack of consistency, biases against families, substance abuse problems, lack of resources, delay in putting resources in place, lack of qualified service providers, child support and other financial obligations, insufficient collaboration, and youth behavioral problems. We'll begin with workforce staffing and lack of consistency. This is a big barrier, and unfortunately, it's the nature of the beast in the child welfare field. In a little bit, we'll talk about the importance of having a positive relationship between the DFS caseworker and the parents and how this is a key component of successful reunification. Unfortunately, as I said, it's the nature of the beast. There's a large turnover in caseworkers in many areas throughout the state. If you've been involved in a lot of termination cases or read a lot of the Supreme Court opinions on termination, you'll notice that in many of these cases, there are numerous DFS caseworkers. I personally have seen cases where there's been six different workers on a case in a matter of 2 years. This is an issue. It's a barrier to reunification. When a family goes from one worker to another, things can change, and these can be big changes for a family in the standards that they're held to and the requirements placed upon them, in the personality of the individual that they're working with. This leads to inconsistency and instability in the case for the family. These staffing issues also include not having enough caseworkers, which is also a problem throughout the state. When you have caseworkers that are handling three times the number of cases that they probably should be handling, things get missed, parents don't get answers, kids don't get visited. You know, this happens with attorneys as well when we have too many cases, when we're not giving enough time to the cases that we have. You know, when we have too many cases, when we're having to shift around and cover other people's cases for one reason or another, things get missed. So this is a barrier to reunification, the lack of consistency in workforce. The next barrier is biases against families. Like I said earlier, we all have families that are difficult to work with. This can lead us to being jaded against the family and having some personal prejudices against them, and perhaps not giving them all of the chances that they deserve. But beyond that one family that we just can't stand are some larger biases against families that put up some pretty huge barriers as well. The majority of families that enter the child welfare system are from lower income families. The majority of professionals in the child welfare system come from middle class families. The majority of foster parents are from middle class families. It's very easy for us to put our middle class values onto these lower class families and expect them to do and have things that are not financially feasible for them. We need to remember that the focus of a child welfare proceeding is the safety of the child. Safety of the child and quality of life of the child are not the same thing. Just because a parent can't afford to pay for a child to play soccer or go to the movies or go on vacation to Disneyland doesn't mean that that child is better off staying in foster care. In fact, the Wyoming Supreme Court put it pretty clearly on this issue in the guardianship of MEO when it said, "Our case law does not permit destruction of a natural parent's fundamental right to the custody of his or her child based simply on the subjective determination of that child's best interest. Were we to allow such a result, the implications are obvious. It is in a child's best interest that he or she Is it in a child's best interest that he or she be raised in an affluent family as opposed to an impoverished family? Would it be better that a child be raised by extremely intelligent parents rather than people of average intelligence? Is a child better off if that child is raised in a conventional lifestyle rather than an unconventional lifestyle?" All of these factors could arguably be considered in determining the child's best interest. However, none even remotely justify denying a parent's constitutional and fundamental right to the custody of his or her child. I love that they use the word affluent in there because it makes me think of the affluenza teen that's been all over the news lately. And I think he's probably a prime example of how money doesn't necessarily equate to good parenting. The next barrier to reunification is substance abuse problems. And boy, this is a big one. Parents with substance abuse problems can be difficult to work with. It can be even more difficult to get these parents the help that they need. Many of them are incredibly resistant to treatment, and it can take a substantial amount of time to get them into treatment. In some areas of the state, it can take quite a while to get them into a provider to even get assessed to see if they need treatment, and then they're on an even longer waiting list to get enrolled in treatment. There are some definite time barriers involved with substance abuse treatment. There can also be issues with the quality of treatment being provided. We have some really good substance abuse providers in this state, and we have some really bad ones. We can say the same thing about attorneys and caseworkers and everyone else. There's some good, there's some bad. An additional barrier that springs out of substance abuse problems is that sometimes a parent's substance abuse issues can overtake the case and everything becomes focused on that parent's continued use. With that being the case, the focus becomes on getting the parent treatment and some other things that may need to be addressed in the case, such as parenting skills, may get overlooked. The next barrier to reunification is lack of resources. This is another big one here in Wyoming. Depending on the community you work in, you could have several mental health providers, or you could have no mental health providers. You could have several substance abuse providers or no substance abuse providers. Nationwide, child welfare professionals are starting to see the benefit of in-home services for families. We only have a few communities here in Wyoming that can provide in-home services. If you have children with special medical or mental health needs, you may have to drive them to Denver to find a provider that can provide you what the child needs. So lack of resources is definitely a barrier. The next barrier is a delay in putting resources in place. I'm not going to talk about this one in detail right now because it's a major component later on. The next barrier is a lack of qualified service providers, which we've already touched on. The next barrier is child support and financial obligations, and I want to talk about this one a little bit. When children are placed in state custody, the state of Wyoming starts a child support action and makes the parents pay child support. This can be a huge barrier to reunification for some of the families that we work with. We know that poverty is one of the main contributing factors to abuse and neglect. In many of these cases, we're requiring parents who can barely support themselves or a household to pay child support, which they can't afford. This becomes particularly concerning if you have a situation where the children are returned to the home on a trial home placement. In cases such as that, the children are in the home, the parents are supporting the children, but the parent potentially could still be paying child support. The parents can also rack up significant arrearages on child support. Along with an abuse and neglect case, there's also other significant financial costs that can come into play when the children are in state custody. Parents now have to take time off work or pay for gas to make it to appointments or visitation. Evaluations and treatment can be incredibly expensive. Sometimes the judge will order the parents to pay attorney's fees. There's just lots of other financial issues that can arise within a case, and all of these factors can create a situation where reunification may not be possible because the system has created a financial crisis for the family. The next barrier is insufficient collaboration, and this one falls right in our laps as professionals. If the professionals in a case are not communicating, if we're not on the same page, if we're not working together, then ultimately reunification may not be successful. We need to be working together as a team to give guidance and support to these families. The last barrier I want to talk about is youth behavioral problems. When I'm working as a parent's attorney and my client's children are in custody, I can almost guarantee that at some point my client is going to come to me and tell me that their child did not have these behavioral problems until they were in foster care. And sometimes my clients are right, sometimes they're wrong. When children are removed from the home, the trauma of that removal and being in a new environment can bring out new behaviors. We know this. We also know that whatever was going on in the home prior to removal may have masked the child's behaviors, or the parent simply didn't notice the behaviors. But these behaviors are an issue we need to deal with. I think in some situations, we sit back and we blame these behaviors on the parents, saying these kids act this way because of the parents. But I also think we need to consider the possibility that maybe these children had these behavioral issues in the home of origin prior to removal, and that these behaviors may have been a contributing factor to whatever went wrong in the home. Sometimes we make the assumption that these parents weren't parenting their children, but the stronger possibility is that these parents were parenting to the best of their abilities or in the only way they know how to parent. They just need some help in learning how to parent the right way. Many of these parents we work with are abused and neglected children themselves who have physically aged into adulthood without being given the opportunity to emotionally and mentally mature into adulthood. So part of the reunification process should be to get their parenting skills to the level where they can handle the behaviors of the children. if we can't do that, or if the parents are unwilling to do that, then we're not even going to have successful visitation, let alone reunification. So those are some of the major barriers to reunification: workforce staffing and lack of consistency, biases against families, substance abuse problems, lack of resources, delay in putting resources in place, lack of qualified service providers, child support and other financial obligations, insufficient collaboration, and youth behavioral problems. Next, we'll talk about factors, those things that make it likely that reunification will not occur. So these are our risk factors. The first risk factor is a family dealing with multiple issues. When a family has multiple issues to deal with, several things can happen. It may all seem so overwhelming, everything that they're being asked to address, that the family never starts to work a case plan. Their children are in foster care, and the parent may just completely check out of the case or disappear. Or a parent may work on one issue, such as we talked about earlier, substance abuse, and the case becomes so focused on that issue that another issue remains masked until it's too late, like the lack of parenting skills. Or there may not be enough time to deal with the multiple issues. It can take years for a parent to fully address substance abuse issues, and by the time they make it to where they need to be, it may be beyond the statutory timelines for achieving permanency. The next risk factor is age of the child. Infants and adolescents are less likely to reunify than other children. We know that attachment issues are a huge consideration when removing young children and infants from the home, and that certainly comes into play here. As to adolescents, all of my research has consistently shown that the odds of reunification are lower for adolescents, but I've yet to find a good explanation as to why that is. Other risk factors for reunification. It's less likely that reunification will be achieved for children of color, children with behavioral problems, and neglected children. The odds of reunification also go down if the parent has a mental health or substance abuse disorder. There are infrequent visitations between the parent and the child. The child comes from a low-income family, or the child has previously been placed in foster care. So now that we've talked about the risk factors and barriers to reunification, let's talk about how we achieve reunification. How do we achieve reunification? We start on day one, the day of removal. And this is an important concept here, another one we should imprint on our brains. The first 60 days are the most important days in a case when working towards reunification. What happens in the first 60 days is the most important thing. This is by far the most critical, important aspect of reunification. Unfortunately, it's also one of the hardest to put into place, especially in areas where the court process can be adversarial and drawn out. Getting to an adjudication within a juvenile case can take some time, and unfortunately, in many cases, services aren't put into place or not accepted by a parent until there is an adjudication. Statutorily, an adjudication should be held within 60 days of the filing of a petition. If services are not put in place until that adjudication or until that 60 days is over, the 60 most important days for reunification may have been wasted. Services for a family should begin immediately upon removal from the home. So what are things that we can do right away to start working towards reunification? It all begins with family engagement. The family has to be involved in working towards reunification, and the family has to be involved in the decision-making process. The family should be allowed input into the placement of the child whenever possible by identifying friends and family who could care for the child. Reunification occurs more frequently when the children are in family or kinship placement. That's something that we know, and it certainly emphasizes the importance of looking for a family placement. We should also try to facilitate as much contact between the parent and child as possible. The more contact, the more frequent the visitations, the more likely reunification will be achieved. Meaningful and frequent visitation is the single best predictor of safe and lasting reunification. This frequent visitation maintains the parent-child relationship and can build trust with the family. But the contact is not just between the parent and the child. We need to make sure that there's good contact between the family and the system as well, be that the court process, that they're updated and aware of what's going on within the court system, or good contact with DFS. They know how to get a hold of their caseworker, they're having contact with their caseworker, they know what their expectations are. Again, the family needs to be engaged in the process as much as possible. Now, this can be difficult if the family is angry or aggressive because of the removal of the child, which we do see, but we need to do as much as we can to involve the family and make sure their voices are being heard. We should also try and minimize disruption to the family. This can be a difficult one to do as well. If possible, the children should be allowed to continue to attend their school, their extracurricular events, church, or anything they're familiar with and that's part of their routine. Parents should be allowed to go watch their choir concert, their band concert, their sporting events. Visitation should be set at a time that's convenient to the family. Parents should be encouraged to share the child's daily routine with their caseworker, and the caseworker should have the foster family incorporate those routines. Now, it's easy to sit here and talk about these things and say that these are the best practice. And in reality, it can be hard to incorporate a lot of these things, especially in areas where we're limited by foster families available, distance between foster home and resources. But we should always be making our best efforts to do things such as this. I want to talk a little bit more about taking the time to make a meaningful and deliberate consideration of a first placement for a child. Often when a child goes into foster care, they end up wherever there happens to be an opening. But when it comes to reunification, the research shows that a first placement choice can have a huge impact on reunification. So what is a meaningful and deliberate consideration of a first placement? It means having the family involved in the decision. Does the child go to foster care or to a relative placement? Does the family have a preference as to the characteristics of the foster family? Has the family worked with a foster family before that they would prefer to have the children? Even if we can't honor these requests, allowing the parents input can help them invest themselves in the process. Meaningful and deliberate consideration also includes considering alternatives to placement outside the home. Are there individuals who could reside in the home with the family and provide assistance to the family? This consideration includes making a placement that will allow pre-placement connections to continue and allow continued involvement of the parents in the child's life. It also includes incorporating any natural resources that the parents may have into the placement. The next step for reunification is to put intensive services in place right away. After these services are in place, if the child could safely reside in the home with those services in place, the child should be returned to the home immediately. The longer the child is out of the home, the less likely reunification will occur. From the perspective of a parent's attorney, your gut reaction in representing a client is to tell them to wait until there's an adjudication to start working on services with the department. For those of you out there who are parents' attorneys, I would encourage you not to do this, as ultimately the early acceptance of services is going to be in your client's best interest, and it's going to help secure an earlier return of the children. The parent can accept services from DFS and start working on things without admitting any guilt, without jeopardizing their rights related to an adjudication. Again, I want to go back to the fact that the family has to be engaged in the process from day one. It all starts on day one. Early emphasis on reunification and a willingness of the system to work with the parents towards reunification can contribute to successful reunification. So how do we engage the family? The first way to engage the family is through family team meetings. And this is a recommendation from the Child Welfare Information Gateway and several national organizations to hold these family team meetings. Well, what are family team meetings? These are meetings above and beyond regular MDT meetings. They can include DFS safety planning meetings. They can include meetings between the GAL, the caseworker, and the family. They can include meetings between DFS and the parents and service providers. They're basically any additional meetings that can be scheduled to put the family together with individuals who are going to be supportive and assist in reunification. And they're done on a regular basis. The key to these meetings is communication. The more frequent the communication, the more involved in the process the parents can be, the more likely it is that reunification can be achieved. It also allows the parents to see that the system is supportive of reunification and there are people that are willing to work with them towards achieving reunification. The next way to engage the family, and another huge factor in ensuring reunification whenever possible, is having supportive foster parents. Again, this can be difficult if the resource is not there. Having the children placed with supportive foster parents, whether it is a family placement or a non-family foster home, can make a huge difference in reunification. When children are placed in foster care with foster parents who don't support reunification, everything can become ultimately more difficult. Foster parents may be resistant to extra visitation. They may be resistant to allowing the parents to call the children on the phone. They may resist taking the children to important family events. There's just numerous ways that a non-supportive foster family can slow the case down. However, supportive foster parents can help facilitate contact, increase visitation, provide positive feedback to the parents, and assist in numerous different ways. Some of the most successful cases that I personally have seen have been when we have a very supportive foster parent that stepped up to the plate and gone the extra mile to help the parent develop the parenting skills they need and mend their relationship with the child. Foster care is meant to be a temporary fix, a temporary safe place for the children to reside until the home of origin is safe, and we need to have supportive foster homes. If you have foster parents that are resistant or even talking about adopting the kids early on in the case, this should be a red flag for you, and you need to consider the fact that maybe the children are not in the right placement. Frequent visits will also engage the family. The more a parent sees a child, the more their focus will remain on getting their child back. Another key factor to reunification and family engagement is a positive relationship between the caseworker and the parent. We've all seen at one time or another what can happen if there is a truly contentious relationship between the parents and the caseworker. It's just not good for anyone. Parents should be able to work with their assigned caseworker, and caseworkers should be able to work with the parents. Now, in almost every case, at one point or another, there's going to be conflict between the parents and the workers. I personally really don't know how some of these caseworkers put up with some of the things they have to deal with, and I certainly wouldn't want to do the job myself. Just because there's conflict between a worker and a parent doesn't mean that there's not a working relationship there. However, if the level of conflict rises to the point that the parent cannot work with the caseworker anymore, it might be time to speak with DFS about assigning another caseworker. The cautionary word on this is always watch out for parents that are shopping for what they deem to be a better caseworker. So we've talked about some of the things we can do to engage the family and increase the likelihood of reunification. So let's turn now to how we assess that the time is right for reunification. We don't just want to work towards reunification. We want to work towards successful reunification. In assessing readiness for reunification, there are several factors we can look at. First, how many children are we reunifying? It's a lot easier to return one child to the home than 10 children to the home. Do we need to send the children home in shifts so that the family can adjust slowly? Can the family take on all of the kids now and be successful? These are considerations we need to make. We also need to consider whether or not the parent's mental health is at a place that they're ready for reunification. If the parent is not mentally ready for the children to return, we're setting everyone up for failure. If mental health is an issue, is the parent continuing their services? Are they taking their medication as prescribed? Are we comfortable that they're ready? We also need to consider the mental health and behavioral issues of the children. We know children act up when their environment changes. In all likelihood, the children are going to misbehave when they return home. They have to readjust to their environment. They're going to test the waters and push the limits with their parents. Are the parents and the children going to be able to weather that storm? Are we comfortable that the parent is going to be able to handle the increased behaviors? We also need to consider whether the financial and physical living situation of the family is going to be appropriate. Are the parents in a position to financially provide for the children? Do the parents have suitable and stable housing? When we're assessing readiness for reunification, we need to consider all of these factors. So to wrap up, reunification should always be the first permanency option in every case because it's the law and because it's what's in the best interest of the children. There are barriers to reunification, and these include workforce staffing and lack of consistency, biases against families, substance abuse problems, lack of resources, delay in putting resources in place, lack of qualified service providers, child support and other financial obligations, insufficient collaboration, and youth behavioral problems. Each of these barriers will have to be addressed and overcome to ensure reunification. The likelihood of reunification is increased when families are engaged in the process through methods such as family team meetings, frequent visitation, consultation and placement decisions, and increased communication. The first 60 days of any case are the most important when it comes to reunification, and we need to start on day one to work towards reunifying the family. The longer a child is out of the home, the less likely it is that reunification will occur. So should we as professionals advocate and work for reunification? Why should we do this? Should we do it because it's our job and we have to? Should we do it because it's in the best interest of the child? Should we do it because someone at some presentation we listened to attended told us that this should be the way we do it? Ultimately, we each decide for ourselves why we advocate for what we advocate for. In child welfare practice, everyone brings to the table their own experiences, biases, prejudices, and opinions. And all of those can be valuable things that we need to work as a team in the child welfare system. This is a hard job that we do day in and day out. Sometimes we get it right, sometimes we get it wrong. But we're doing a valuable job, and what we do makes a difference in the lives of the people we work with. The children we work with and work for rely on us to do the best job possible to ensure that they get the things that they need in their life. We owe it to them to do the best that we can to ensure that they have the opportunity to lead what they consider normal lives. With all this being said, one of the biggest predictors of reunification is parental compliance with services. We have an obligation as professionals to do everything we can to ensure reunification. But if we have parents that are unwilling or unable to do what needs to be done to secure the return of their children, ultimately we may need to make that decision that reunification is not the appropriate permanency option for the children. But when we make that decision, we need to have confidence that we have done everything we as professionals can do to help the family move towards reunification so that we can look these children and these families that we work with and advocate for in the eye and tell them we did everything we could to reunify and preserve your family and that we made reunification our first priority as a permanency option. Thank you for listening today, and if there are any questions, I will take them now.
Thank you, Lisa. We have the chat lines and the phone lines open if people want to either type in a question or call in on the phone. Lisa, I had one question or maybe an ask for you to expand on information, but you talked about family engagement and how important it is to have family engagement meetings in addition or above and beyond MDTs. And you talked about safety planning meetings. Can you just maybe share some of your experiences from a GAL perspective and parent attorney about what's happening at those safety planning meetings and what those look like?
The majority of the safety planning meetings that I have attended have been to develop a safety plan for the family, and they're very oriented to reunification. In fact, the majority of them happen shortly prior to reunification, where we come up with a safety plan and we put a safety plan in place so that the kids can return to the home when there are still some concerns, with a plan in place so that if something that may be harmful to the child occurs, certain things happen to protect the child. One of the most common ones that I see is in a domestic violence situation when the parents have been engaged in a series of domestic violence in the presence of the children. After the parents have done what they need to get reunification back and we're comfortable moving the kids into the home, we have a safety planning meeting to develop the safety plan that should mom and dad start to argue, dad is going to leave the home. Should mom and dad start to argue, mom is going to take the children to the neighbor's house. Some sort of plan in place so that the family knows what is expected of them and that there's a plan in place to protect the children once they're reunified in the home. Now, I know that there are some, and I'm sure they're called different things throughout the state, but sometimes DFS will hold a meeting to establish a safety network. And that's a meeting that the attorneys aren't necessarily involved in, but it involves the DFS caseworker, the family, and anyone that they deem a support to establish those natural resources within the parent's life of people that they can rely on. And those would be such as the neighbor where mom would go if mom and dad get in a fight. The neighbor would be part of the safety plan, and the neighbor would attend the meeting, and the neighbor would commit to, I will take the family into my home if mom and dad get in a fight again. So those are the typical safety meetings that I see.
Okay, again, the chat line's open and phone lines are open. And I don't see any other questions coming in, Lisa. So any sort of final closing remarks or things you want to leave listeners with or thinking about?
You know, I go back to those two things that I emphasized throughout my presentation. The first 60 days in any case are the most important in working towards reunification, and services have to be put in place right away. We can't just sit back and say we're going to wait for an adjudication and then we're going to start working on this case. We need to be setting up services. We need to be making sure that visitation is frequent, that contact between the parent and the child is frequent. We need to do everything that we can as professionals to facilitate those things. And then the other item is, again, the longer a child remains out of the home, the less likely it is to reunify. So we need to actively work towards reunification at the front end of these cases to try and get these children back into their homes of origin, because all the research tells us it's in the best interest of the children to be with their parents. And for the majority of these children, that is where they want to be. So those are the final words I would impart on everyone.
Well, thank you so much, Lisa. This has been a great presentation. I've had lots of people emailing and texting me that this has been one of our better Blog Talk Radios. So thank you again for taking time to put together the presentation and deliver this message. For listeners out there, our next Blog Talk Radio is scheduled for February 11th, and many of the attorneys and judges might have been following the release of new pattern jury instructions. And so our February 11th Blog Talk Radio will focus on a review of those new pattern jury instructions for abuse and neglect, CHINs, delinquency, and termination of parental rights cases. So again, would encourage everyone to tune back in for our February Blog Talk Radio. Thanks again to everyone that listened today, and I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day. Thank you.